listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Good evening and welcome to Aloud at Central Library. I am so thrilled to introduce Carl Merlantes to you tonight. A writer I greatly admire, and Tom Kerwin, another writer I greatly admire. Before I'll give you a little briefing, I'm Louise Steinman, the curator of the Aloud series and the cultural programs director for the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Carl Merlantes is a decorated Marine Corps officer and veteran of Vietnam. He wrote his novel Matterhorn over 30 years while also raising a family and working full-time as a business consultant. Matterhorn has been hailed as a masterpiece. Among the many awards it has received is the Marine Corps Heritage Foundation's James Webb Award for Distinguished Fiction, just one among many. I read Matterhorn last summer high up in the sky on a flight from Europe, and I didn't sleep the entire 13 hours because I was there with Sergeant Mellis on that jungle path, on that ridge in the fog in Vietnam, with those 40 brave and terrified Marines under Sergeant Mellis's command. Another great writer and thinker about the costs of war spoke from this stage a few years ago, and I wanted to mention him because his work is so relevant tonight, and also to pay tribute to him because he passed away a few days ago. That was the Jungian psychologist James Hillman. And when James was here last, he spoke about his book, A Terrible Love of War. He wrote, he's writing about the different gods of war, and he writes, Ares and Aphrodite indistinguishable. Death and loveliness held in one vision. A German soldier on the Western Front in 1914 dreams, I came into a room and a beautiful, ravishing woman advanced to meet me. I wanted to kiss her, but as I approached her, I found a skull grinning at me. For one moment, I was paralyzed with horror, but then I kissed the skull, kissed it so eagerly and violently that a fragment of its underjaw remained between my lips. It is this fusion of death and loveliness, writes Hillman, that makes war so spectacular and terrible, brutal and transcendent within a single moment. And it is that beauty and transcendence, the love of war and the sorrow of war, that Carl Merlantes so brilliantly addresses in his new book, What It Is Like to Go to War. What do you need to know to go to war? What do you need to know about coming back from war? In the past, Merlantes reminds us, warriors were prepared for battle by ritual, religion, and literature. Now, he observes, our soldiers are actually less prepared than their ancestors to deal psychologically with the experience of combat and its inherent moral compromises. Merlantes writes that the Army trained him to kill, but, quote, it didn't teach me how to deal with a killing. What is at stake, he writes, is not only the psyches of our young fighters, but our humanity. And as thousands upon thousands of American troops head home from Iraq and Afghanistan, Merlantes' book is essential reading for all of us. In conversation with Carl Merlantes tonight is Tom Kerwin, who is one of LA's great treasures. When you read an amazing long-form narrative piece in the Los Angeles Times, look at the byline, and it's probably written by Tom. He brings a poetic sensibility and a deep insight to his stories. He's worked as the editor of the outdoor section, as a writer at large, and as an editor for the features section, and as deputy editor of the LA Times Book Review. And in 2008, he was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. It gives me great pleasure, and it is a deep honor. Please join me in welcoming Carl Merlantes and Tom Kerwin to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Thank you, Louise. Nice introduction. Good evening. How are we all doing tonight? It's nice to see your faces. Nice to see the gathering here. Credit here, of course, goes to the Library Foundation and to Louise for bringing together such a wonderful evening event such as tonight and what she does twice a week at the library here. It's worthy of all of our support here. And I it's nice to see that we have it tonight. What a great introduction, that very stunning bit of writing by James Hillman. And as I was listening to that, I was thinking about Carl's books. And if you don't know these books, I really do recommend them. They're really quite extraordinary. And I sit here with these books, listening to that introduction, and just sort of thinking about how searing Hillman's words are, and I add it to Carl's words as well. I read these books, and as we all do, we sit back, we read in our living rooms or in our bedrooms, wherever we're reading, on the buses, and we think about who the people are that have written these books. And to suddenly be in Carl's company and to sit beside him and watch and listen to him on the stage here, you suddenly get the impression that this guy has been through an awful lot of living in the course of some 50-odd years. It's really quite remarkable what he manages to pack into these books and the experiences that he's had. Carl and I first met earlier this year at the LA Times Festival of Books, and we were on a panel there, and he was talking about Matterhorn at the time, and I had the chance to ask him a question, and I'll turn that question over to him tonight to begin with. I'm always interested in how writers begin their work. What is it that they keep as a touchstone to get them into the various heavens and hell that they get into in their fiction and in their nonfiction? And Carl mentioned as we were talking there that he keeps an object there by his desk, two objects perhaps.
Yes, yes.
By his desk as sort of a touchstone that takes him somewhere when he thinks about them.
Yeah, it's a pair of boots. That's the two objects. And they were one of the pairs of boots that I wore in Vietnam. I'd worn another pair out. You do an awful lot of walking. And these boots, after you're in the jungle and you are no longer a rookie, they change color. They turn almost white with being bleached by the sun and constant exposure to water. And I could actually touch those boots and sort of, you know, and remember, you know, wearing them. And there's a slit across the top of one of them where I think it was a piece of shrapnel that just missed me and just sliced across the boot. And I can just look at that and go like, that was close. You know, and it's the feel of those boots, and also, as I was saying a little earlier, it was there's sort of a bit of a badge about white boots. It means that you're one of the ones that has been there. You have walked the ground, and it's something that I feel proud about, that I did share that experience with. Some amazing, wonderful people, and the boots bring me back all the time.
And what's interesting is that you are still walking that ground. You're in Vietnam for how many years?
Well, I was there 13 months.
13 months.
Yeah, seemed like a lot of years.
And this was 1967 to 1968.
68, 69.
Yeah. And you're still walking that ground.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that I hopefully am about done having gotten both of these books out. But I had a lot to deal with. And one of the things that I wanted to deal with, which I dealt with in Matterhorn, was I just wanted to tell our story. What is it like to be 19 and have to make the decisions that you make, have to do the killing that you do, grow up so fast? And yet, you know, we were all just terribly young. I was the second oldest in my company, over 200 Marines at one point, and I was 23. And the company commander was 23 as well. He was a first lieutenant, 6 months older than me, an ex-fraternity president from USC. And then it goes from that to running a company in Vietnam. I mean, it's incredible. So that was what was a lot of the motivation about Matterhorn. And then the second book was, I had my own demons to deal with, and one of them that was very influential in getting me started writing this is that I had been involved in an assault on a fortified position, very steep hill, and some NVA soldiers were up above us, and they threw hand grenades down at us, and we were hit by the first two, and I was knocked unconscious, and one of my friends was fairly badly wounded. He lived. And there were just three. I came too, and was kind of a mess. And we threw our grenades back, and then they threw grenades back at us. And then we threw our grenades back. And finally, you know, the lieutenant sitting here thinking, we're going to run out of grenades here if we don't do something. And so I told these guys, I said, I'm going to go around to the side. And then when you throw the grenades, I'll be there waiting so that when these two guys pop up to throw their grenades back, I'll get them with my M16. So I got into position, and I was a bloody mess. Oops, sorry. I was on the ground, no further away from the fighting hold in the first row here, and one of the NVA soldiers was already dead. And the other one rose up with the grenade in his hand, and he looked at me, and we locked eyes. Now, that's very rare. And suddenly, he was just a kid like me. And I remember wishing I could speak Vietnamese, and I remember whispering in English out loud, don't throw it. If you don't throw it, I won't pull the trigger. If you don't throw it, I won't pull the trigger. And he just threw it at me, and I pulled the trigger. And at the moment, it was like not much feeling at all. I remember thinking, you know, I bucked my shot. I anticipated the recoil, and I didn't have quite a clean hit. It hit the dirt just in front of him and then went into him. So, and then we were terribly busy, and the assault was going on. And 20 years later, in 1990, I'm driving down a highway, and, you know, country music on, 2 a.m, little bubble of light. Veterans love to drive late at night. It's all because we've got control. And these two eyes popped up in the windshield. I could see them right in front of me. And I knew then that I had to deal with killing somebody that was a human being. And the way that you get around it, and the way all decent people get around it, is that you, for a moment, just think of them as some kind of an animal, some kind of a different species who's trying to hurt you and your friends. But at some point, you wake up in the middle of the night, or your mind is wandering freely and you're down the road, up pops the eyes. And I knew that then I needed to deal with it in a serious way, and I deal with things because I'm a writer by writing. And that was the genesis of the start of this book, trying to deal with what is in fact something we don't talk about in this culture, which is that we're all raised to be decent people, you know, Judeo-Christian traditions, and thou shalt not kill. And then we send the 19-year-olds out there to do the killing for the country, and then they come back, and after having gone against everything that they've been taught, and then what? If they're lucky, you get a job at McDonald's or something. And we just don't speak about this, and we don't think about talking about to kids who are joining the military. I'm not a pacifist, but I do think we waste our 19-year-olds lots of times. And I don't want romantics joining the Army or the Marine Corps. I want them to understand what they're doing, and I think that if we talk to them ahead of time, they're 19, you know, they're going to roll their eyes. I mean, I know them. But if you can tell them ahead of time that this is what you're going to do, and you are going to start to see things like this and feel things like this, the human body strategy for healing is to take the blow and heal fast. We're not turtles or armadillos. We don't have armor. We take the blow, but we heal fast. And so what I'm hoping is there's no way you're going to stop the 19-year-old from receiving the blow of the wound to the soul of killing people, or of his psyche getting shattered. But you can speed up the healing by telling them ahead of time what they're going to experience, what they're going to look for when they come home. If I had known what's in this book, I think my family would have suffered at least a decade less than they did, because I would have been on top of it faster. But I was completely ignorant of it.
You write towards the end, this book is my song.
Mm-hmm.
Each and every one of us veterans must have a song to sing about our war before we can walk back into the community.
Yeah, that there's a Navajo myth called Two Brothers to the Sun, and it's about two warrior brothers who take a journey to the sun, and they have to fight monsters on the way, and they go through all the harrowing experiences of combat, and they succeed, and they come back to their village, and everybody in the village is afraid of them because they have lightning coming out of their bodies, lightning bolts, and everybody's like, no one was going to talk to them, they're frightened of them. The Irish, the Tain, a great Irish epic, has the same thing with Cuchulainn, who's the Irish hero coming back, and he's so on fire, and he's got swans flying around his head, and people are just frightened of him. And the way that these people got reintegrated was in the case of the Navajos, is that they sent them to Spider Woman, and Spider Woman taught them to sing, and they began to sing, and as they sang, the lightning bolts started going away, and they finally sang themselves back into the community, and rejoined the community because that incredible affect of having been at war got smoothed out. I was actually led through a sand painting ceremony that reenacted that whole myth, and it was very important to me, and so. In large part, that's the song.
Yeah, and that's sort of the flavor of this book. Is you know, not only do you have passages in which there are lightning bolts coming out of the prose, but there's also the thoughtfulness that goes behind it. I was reading this and I was thinking to myself, this could you have a memoir to write that could strictly have been a memoir of your days in Vietnam, but you obviously felt the need to write more than just a memoir here.
Yeah.
You wanted to. You know, it's not so much a polemic that you've written, but there's certainly it's less impressionistic, let's put it that way, than a memoir.
Yeah.
So your lightning bolts came out in sort of a different sort of way.
Yeah. I felt, you know, when I started writing it, I put one of my favorite quotes from Bismarck at the beginning of the book, and I can't quote him exactly, but the paraphrasing that quote. Any fool can learn from his own mistakes. The wise person learns from somebody else's mistakes. And what I had hoped is that if I could really analyze and really get honest about what happened and some of the mistakes I made, some of the things I thought I did right, then maybe someone reading the book would learn from what I've done instead of having to repeat it and do it again. And clearly, you know, we in our culture blindly repeat. You know, it's human. Being human, we repeat things over and over that we should be able to stop. And so that was the sort of the sense of the feeling that by just getting honest, which wasn't easy. I mean, yeah. You know, there's stuff in there. You know, it's like, you know, I got my wrist slashed, and I didn't want to write about it because it wasn't very pleasant. But I thought, you know, if you're not going to do this right, then write a memoir. And there's 1,000 memoirs, and you know, and so what? Because the experience of war is pretty much the same for everybody. Different hills, different enemies, but the experience hasn't changed since Odysseus, in reality. But it's what are we thinking about it today? Given all the changes that have happened in our culture.
And I guess before we get into that side of the book, just to give you a sense of flavor of the book here, and so it's just not sort of this theoretical conversation of sorts about heroism and valor and the role of the warrior in today's society, to give you a sense of Carl's gift as a writer, I wanted him to read a passage here that is not only sort of harrowing in its own right, but also is pretty revealing under his character. The value of this book is this man has been through this experience and is not bashful in sharing that with us.
Yeah, this is the passage about Utter. This is a pseudonym, but this was another assault on a hill, and I had left the platoon. I'd been promoted to company executive officer, which means that you're like the vice president, you know, and they stick you at the back of the column and the skipper's at the front, and because so if he gets killed, then you're not going to get killed. And basically, you do the odd jobs, administrative, out in the field. I mean, it's not, you don't have a typewriter. But that was the position that I'd just been promoted to. And my old platoon had gone into the assault, and I couldn't stand it. They were, I loved these guys, you know. It's just that simple. And I couldn't stand to see them going into an assault without me. And since I didn't have anything to do, I just turned to the skipper and said, I got to go with them. And I didn't care what he said anyway. I went with them. And in the middle of this assault, one of the kids went down uphill from us. Since I didn't have anything to do, I decided to go after him, and this is the section that I write about that. I threw myself against the hillside, so steep here that both of us were actually standing, leaning our backs against it, looking out over the valley below us. Bullets exceeding the sound barrier made loud sonic snaps over our head, but we were safe in this little cup that protected us. Utter's magazine hadn't been properly seated, causing the bolt to hang up on its forward edge, a common problem with the M16. I cleared it for him, fired a short burst, and handed the rifle back to him. I asked him where his squad leader was. He didn't know exactly. Over there someplace. I looked up over the lip of the cup and could see that the brush had been carefully cleared away from the ground up to about knee level. By this time, I'd been around long enough to know this meant a machine gun emplacement. They'd shoot the legs first. When the attacker fell, the bullets would finish him off as the body fell through the kill zone. I grabbed Utter by the shirt and forced his head above the lip to show him the trap, shouting at him not to go up that way, to try to find some way around. He stared at the cut brush. I yanked him down and I told him to stay put. I'd find his squad leader and we'd get a team together and get the gun by flanking it from the left side. Don't go up there. He nodded, still dazed with fear. I made him shoot a couple of rounds. He nodded. He was all right. I took off to organize an attack on the machine gun. As I left the protection of the cup, I saw Utter take off, straight up the hill. I'll never know why. Perhaps he too wanted to be a hero. Maybe he just wanted to show me he was a good Marine. He was 18. My former platoon sergeant, Staff Sergeant Bell, came running around from the opposite side. His radio man, Lance Corporal Putnam, piled into the hillside right after him. Bell, a terrific platoon sergeant, was doing the same thing I was, trying to get the two squads back together, but from the other direction, so the gap was getting closed. I shouted at him, "Utter's just gone up the hill toward that machine gun. Where in the hell's second squad?" He just pointed over his shoulder and leaned his back against the side of the hill, his chest heaving. I saw movement in the brush and heard the sound of an M16, so I knew that Bell and the second squad leader had closed the gap. Then we all heard the enemy machine gun open up. You can definitely tell this machine gun by its heavy popping sound, methodical and hammer-like, unlike the heavy slapping sound of the AK-47 or the tense, high-pitched scream of our own M16s. I heard Utter cry out, "I'm hit." The machine gun kept firing. I looked at Bell, and he looked at me. He shook his head, lips pressed tight. I finally said, "I don't have anything else to do. I'll go get him." Bell looked directly at me, and he said, "Don't go up there, Lieutenant." I was split three ways. I'd known Utter for months. He was my guy, even though I'd just been replaced. He was hit. I simply wanted to get him before he bled to death. Another part of me was screaming to listen to Bell and stay safe. Then there was the third part. I wanted a medal.
That's what Carl has done in this book, in which he's taken these little, extraordinary little vignettes about his experience in combat and tied them on to bigger themes: killing, guilt, numbness and violence, the enemy within, lying, loyalty, heroism, home, the club. These are the chapter headings of the book. he is definitely onto something bigger than just telling us about what it's like to be in war. He's into trying to tell us what it's like to go to war, trying to help us understand that complicated experience. It's a hard message to get out, isn't it?
Yeah, I have the feeling of trying to turn the Queen Mary, but I'm a 7-horsepower Johnson on the bow, you know. it's the culture. It's very difficult, but writers have influence. We don't have power, but we do have influence, and you know, so it's something that I accept as part of literature and part of writing. It's just something that you can do. You can help, you know, put some ideas out there, and maybe in 50 years the Queen Mary might turn, you know. But if you don't start the outboard on the bow, it's not going to turn ever. So I kind of.
And it's taken a degree of tenacity. I mean, Matterhorn, I mean, why don't you share the story of the publishing history of Matterhorn?
Matterhorn.
I mean, this is a good example of just how difficult it is, I think, for our society and for readers and for publishers to sort of embrace the reality of what you're talking about.
Yeah. When I first tried to publish Matterhorn in 1977, and no one would read it. You know, Vietnam War, you know, we can't sell that. And they probably were right. I mean, the way the country felt about the war in 1977 was probably, you know, not real good for selling books. And so I finally put it away after about 20 or 25 rejection slips. I can only take so much. And no one had read it. And so I worked on it, you know, again. I kept plugging away at it, cutting it, adding things to it. And it was really good that it didn't get published when I wanted it to, because I was too young to really get into my characters, to really understand what was happening to me. Mid-80s, I tried it again, and then the answers were, well, you know, you missed the market. There's no market, because Hollywood's already done it. Full Metal Jacket, Platoon, Apocalypse Now. We can't sell a book on Vietnam. And so I, you know, after about 20 or 25 of rejection slips, I went back to, you know, raising my family. By this time, I had 4. And mid-90s, I honestly got a couple people who wrote back very helpfully saying, well, listen, you know, we can't sell a book on Vietnam, but why can't you just take these characters and move them into the Gulf and just write the book from the Gulf War strategy, because that's very tough. And I was so pleased that Microsoft had come out with Search and Replace, because I could just do Desert and Jungle and just give a whole new book. You know? I mean, that's sort of funny. I mean, but you know, these people have to make a living. They have to guess what the market's going to be. They have to guess if it's going to sell, or if they can place it with a publisher, or if the publisher can make it sell. And they just thought that it probably wouldn't. And honestly, in the aughts, I actually had some of them writing me back saying, well, it's got a mountain in it. Afghanistan's got lots of mountains. Why don't you just move this company to Afghanistan? We can probably sell that. So 35 years, you know, finally, a little tiny outfit in Berkeley, California named El Leon Literary Arts, 2 people, nonprofit, published it. My pay was 120 free copies, and they made a run of 1,200 books, and it got into the hands of Morgan Entrekin from Grove, and there it is.
And you kept us in Vietnam.
Yeah. yeah, I did not. I mean, you know, the typical thing for writers, you know, write what you know about. There'd be nothing worse than a writer writing about something he has no experience with.
Right.
I mean, it's just, you see it. I mean, people who have had that experience will just go like, ugh. So I couldn't write about the Gulf.
You know, it's interesting, the reluctance. I mean, there certainly is, certainly with Vietnam, there's a stigma. And I think Vietnam sort of sits in our conscience as being sort of the war that we're still ashamed of Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
in ways that we're perhaps not so ashamed of maybe Iraq and maybe mm-hmm. Afghanistan. Maybe it's our culture has changed a little bit, but Vietnam still occupies a dark place in our imagination, and so you decided to throw light on it in spite of the fact that, you know, some people were saying its time had come and gone.
Yeah, no, it's. I think that it's an incredible watershed in our culture, Vietnam. For example, before Vietnam, you couldn't point to either political party and say they're pro-military, they're anti-military. After Vietnam, you could do that. When I was at Yale, and I got to Yale in 63, there was a huge plaque on the wall at Wolseley Hall, giant bronze plaque with the names of hundreds of dead Yalies from World War I, World War II, and Korea. How many Ivy Leaguers are even in the military today? That's Vietnam. I mean, our republic went in a bad direction from Vietnam because we have failed to really deal with a lot of the fallout from it. And there's two examples right there.
Yeah, and I guess that pair of boots that those bleached boots that you hold and sort of feel your presence in Vietnam and in their company and in their presence. Mm-hmm. Vietnam is also that broader touchstone for you to in what it's like to go to war, to open up the conversation, to help us reconsider the role of soldiers and warriors in our society.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that one of the things that's so difficult for returning veterans, even today's wars, is that we have some kind of an unconscious attitude that the veteran is the one that goes to war. We all pay our taxes, and we all teach in the schools that teach the scientists who build the weapons, and we all grow the food, and we all finance the factories. I mean, we are an incredible interconnected chain of being and these connections. And what the veteran, what the soldier did is that he was at the end of the chain where he pulled the trigger. We went to war, but we don't believe it. And, I think that it's something that happened again in Vietnam. World War II, my dad and my uncles, I mean, yeah, that was when they were in the service. Oh, there's another thing that changed. It was called the service. Now it's called the military. That's from Vietnam. I mean, it's an incredible watershed. But everybody sort of knew. I mean, you know, all the women in town had brothers and husbands that had fought in the war, and they knew what a division was and what a platoon was. And I mean, it was just part of the whole culture participated in the republic participated in it. Now we don't do that. And I think there's this unconscious attitude of, well, they volunteered, we paid them. I mean, we have to be nice to them when they come home. We shouldn't, be mean to them like we were to the Vietnam veterans, but it's kind of a false standard. I mean, it's a sort of a negative standard. If we're not being mean to them, then that's good. We sent them to war, and they're going to have a very difficult time coming back. I was at a radio show about 3 weeks ago with three Afghan veterans. And I was sitting in the green room and talking, and one of them has just been back 2 years. He's at the University of Washington. And in the 2 years since he's been back, three of his friends from his little unit have committed suicide. Hmm. So clearly, we're not doing the job. And I think that a lot of deep thinking is going to have to be done about this, because we got them coming back in droves right now.
No, that's powerful. I mean, all the yellow ribbons that say support our troops only go so far.
Exactly. Yeah, the work has to be done now. And people say, well, why does the military take care of it? Well, these reintegration problems, the alcoholism, the divorce rates, the joblessness, the rages, the murders, they pop up 5 years, 10 years, even 15. I mean, those popped up 20 years later for me. So it's got to be us, the civilian population, that deals with this, because they're out of the military. They'll be out of the military for 10 years. The military can do a better job. And they're, quite frankly, I've been at the Air Force Academy. I've been at Quantico, the Marine Corps sort of school. And I've been at West Point and the Naval Academy because of these books. And they actually are trying to deal with it. But as one very frustrated Marine colonel said to me, he was just like this, he was like, whoa, we're Marines, we're not psychologists. And I went, yeah, you're right. They can only do so much. And what we have them doing, and they ought to be doing, is being our warriors. We've got to take care of these veterans. And I think that we think we're done when we clap for them when they come home in the airport.
So I guess what's interesting is that you're trying to suggest a different definition of a soldier than what perhaps our culture and our society currently accepts as soldiers. Yeah. You're suggesting that a soldier or a warrior be defined by someone who has more of a sort of a kind of a more humanistic approach to killing.
Yeah, if you think about the military, it's really interesting. The name's gone right out of my head now, but a famous British historian pointed out that the military is actually one of the great civilizing changes in our culture. Up until about, you know, the 16th or 17th century, before the regimental system came into Europe, basically it was just a bunch of brigands running around. There was no check on the slaughter, no nothing. You think of what they call the condottieri that were in northern Italy. Whoever paid them, they'd kill anybody, you know. And it was only when the state actually had soldiers that were disciplined that we began to start to control the violence. And that was a step forward. And I guess what I'm writing about now is we can still do better. A warrior, in my definition, is somebody that chooses a side. That's the first thing, they choose a side. And they are willing to use violence to stop someone else from using violence against our side. And they're willing to risk maiming and death doing it. If that definition of the warrior is taken seriously, then when we get in wars, they had better be wars where someone is trying to use violence against us, and the only way of stopping it is to send our 19-year-olds to do it. Mm-hmm. We often send our kids into situations that are murky. And Vietnam was a great example. I mean, we ended up with body count. Body count is, as a measurement, goes against every grain in a warrior's body. He's there to protect people. That's the ethical warrior. He's not there to kill people. He happens to kill people trying to protect his side. And if you put these kids into situations where they are just there to kill as many enemies as they can, you've already put them into a really difficult spot. How are they going to deal with that? I mean, what was I doing there? And it's up to the adults not to commit them to those kinds of situations. As long as I'm on a roll here. A policeman can't choose sides. He has to be on the side of the law. And it requires a very different personality. 19-year-olds are the best warriors. Can you imagine 35-year-olds? Okay, we're going to take the hill. Wait a second, Lieutenant, let's think about this. Right. It's not going to work. 19-year-old, we're going to go do it. But that's a different animal than a mature man who's a policeman. And what we're doing is that we've got the police who are on the side of the law in situations where there's no law anymore. I mean, at least here in this country, everybody in every state pen in the country says, well, yeah, it's against the law to kill people and steal. We agree. In Afghanistan, what law are we sending our guys over there to uphold? Sharia law? Western European law? Tribal law? I mean, you know, it's just like, it's really different.
But you almost get the impression that we don't want our soldiers to be informed. That your prescription for a humanist soldier is a prescription for sort of an unaggressive army. That I think is the impression. I mean, we like our 19-year-olds not to know what they're going to fight because they'll fight more fiercely for what they don't know.
I think that's wrong. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean,
I think is a common assumption.
I think that's an assumption. Right. I mean, the 19-year-olds that I fought with would fight fiercely, no matter what we had talked to them about before, because once you're into it, it's almost genetic. I mean, once you get into combat, you're there to get the job done and to keep your friends alive and to keep yourself alive. And, you know, believe me, the aggression will be there. We are not the top animal on the food chain because we're nice. I mean, you know, there is not a species on this planet that has challenged us. And because we are a very aggressive species, and when you unleash this with young men in particular, but men and women both in the military today, you arm them with weapons and say it's okay, believe me, out it comes. I think we have the opposite problem, which is to not go to excess. But I don't at all think that telling people what's going to happen to them and when to notice that they might be slipping into something that's not healthy, that's going to lead to excess. I don't think that's going to stop the aggression at all.
I think that's interesting because, of course, as I'm reading your book, I'm sort of following your prescription for this new sort of thoughtful kind of soldier that sort of has a clearer sense of who the enemy is, has a clearer sense of his role in society and what he's fighting for, what he or she are fighting for. And part of me was thinking to myself, well, this would be not the aggressive army and the fierce army, because there would be too much sort of internal debate in the soldier before going into war, the more informed they are. Which I guess made me think about your book and made me sort of feel like in this book, as we were talking about earlier, that in some manner I feel like it feels, as much as I admire what you're doing here, that you're kind of swimming upstream. You're going against culture,
yeah.
and trying to get this message out there.
Yeah, no, I think it's there's no doubt about that. But I'm encouraged because, like I said, I spent an hour with the woman who's in charge of the curriculum at the Air Force Academy, and she was very interested, particularly in the part that I was talking about. The new technology of being able to use drones and kill people from some air-conditioned air base in Nevada and drive home after work and, have dinner with the kids and go to the soccer game. This is something that we need to really start thinking about, because the technology is going to just exceed the rate of development of our hearts. And believe me, it's not going to... You don't turn the technology around. Is someone at a reason, well, why don't we ban drones? I said, because the other side is going to have them in about 10 years. Don't worry, and they're already watching the way we use them. We're setting the precedent for how they're used. Even
scary picture.
Yeah, but it's going to happen. And so now what do we do? We have to think about how we're going to use this technology, and if we don't. We can get ourselves into situations where I think we're doing excess killing we don't need to do.
I guess, though, that's what I was thinking about, is as strong a prescription as this book is for what the new breed of a warrior for our society would be, I feel that there's so much in our culture right now that is working against that prescription. Ours is a culture based on speed, efficiency,
mm-hmm.
and certainly a form of brutality, if not in popular culture, than in our world.
Well, look at our movies.
And I was reminded of a friend of mine who was a correspondent from Iraq, and not only is the problem sort of with our culture, but he was painting this picture. He tells the story about how we often think of the Band of Brothers, okay, and how what mm-hmm. a great Tom Hanks and the sort of progress across Europe during World War II. He says, when I was in Iraq, it was the exact opposite. He said the soldiers that I was with, they'd go out on their patrols during the day. And they'd get in their Humvees and they'd drive around scared shitless as they'd be going through the streets of Baghdad, and they'd get back into their camp and they'd sit there on their cots with their DVD players, sit up on their stomachs, and they'd watch movies plugged into their iPods, separated from their band of brothers.
Mm-hmm. Or they would email their girlfriends back home or talk to them on their cell phones. This and what that is doing is that it's blending what I call the sacred space, where you're actually taking life or losing your own life with common, ordinary life. And the more that they become confused, I think the more dangerous it becomes. It just becomes too easy to just say it's part of everyday life. Oh, well, we've got a problem in Yemen. Call up the drone people and take care of it. And it's too easy.
So what's the alternative?
I think the alternative is unfortunately the old-fashioned stuff, which is consciousness raising through education, through older people talking to younger people. I think that certainly in the military they can take more time in their curriculums today. There's, I think, zero time spent on issues like this. And as I was talking to, I wish I could remember her name, General somebody at the Air Force Academy, she was saying, well, even if we had, 6 or 8 hours in the course of a semester on it, she said, I'm going to have to fight a major battle because people are going to say it's a waste of our cadets' time because we got to teach them this and this and this, and this was all technical. And I'm going like, if you had 6 hours, which is an infinite amount more than zero, I think you'd make major progress, because I was just talking to these kids and at one of the classes, it was an English class, and they had not thought that what they're doing is killing people. They were there sort of learning about, you know, drones and organizational efficiency and how to manage and, you know, that. And it was all sort of very interesting. But I was kind of amazed. I said, you know, what you're really doing, you know, you're using this technology to kill our country's enemies. And that's what you're really doing. And I don't care if you're a clerk or if you're a truck driver, you're part of that process, the thing I just started off with. And they're just closer to the end of the spear. They hadn't thought about it. And I don't think that's good, because they're going. I had a friend wake up about 5 years ago. He was an Air Force pilot, and you know, typical of Air Force pilots. I mean, in today's, even back in Vietnam, the technology had gotten to the point where he didn't even see anybody that he was killing, and he pickled a load on a village that was a target that was, you know, an assigned target, and he did the job, and he flew back. And 5 years ago, he woke up screaming in the middle of the night, realizing that he had probably killed innocent people that weren't combatants. It'll come and get you. And I think that we need to just make sure that people know it, and as well as our leaders know it. I mean, I think that it's grow up, you guys, you know? I mean, that's just that simple. Grow up. We need more adults.
And I guess what strikes me is that behind all this, sort of sitting in the wings, is our sort of peculiar relationship to our own mortality, to killing, to death. I mean, war soldiers are there to kill people, and are trained to kill people.
Yeah.
And we don't want to have to address that.
No, we don't want to deal with death at all. I mean, I told this joke in the book, but I used to work in India, and I was having drinks one night with one of my managers at what's called the Bengal Club in Calcutta, and he leans over the table and he looks at me and he says, "Marlanus," he says, "you Americans are the only nation on the planet that thinks that death is an option." And I thought, well, yeah, I'm insured. No problem. And our culture does not deal with it. Our culture does, even our own religion, it has, you know, dark sides. I mean, you think of the Jewish Bible and the Christian Bible. There's dark stories in there, dark, dark stories of, you know, torture. And I mean, the crucifixion is an ugly thing, but we don't want to do that. We want Christmas.
And in the same way that drone pilot who lives in that suburb in the outside of Las Vegas, Nevada, can go to work and clock in at 8 o'clock in the morning and clock out at 5 p.m. after sending a drone over some village in Pakistan.
Right.
In the same way that individual is distanced from war, our culture is distanced from war.
Yeah, I think
the same pernicious effect occurs between his internal psyche and the culture's psyche.
Yeah. No, I think that obviously the military is part of the culture. It's an increasingly isolated part of the culture.
And it's that isolation that's the problem.
How can someone come home if the people that are home sort of feel like, well, you know, we don't want to hear about what you did over there. Right. We have this code of silence. And I mean, in my own family, I didn't know until I was 50 that my father was in the Battle of the Bulge. I was 50 years old when he finally sort of coughed that one up, and I was like, Dad, you know? Well, yeah, he never asked me. You know, I mean, I got stories about, you know, how he got drunk on Calvados in Normandy and, you know, those kinds of funny stories, and the time that they loaded the troop ship backwards, you know.
Right.
We can handle that, but the culture does not want to handle death and dying, and so we don't. And I think that it impedes our ability to wage war more humanely. And people say, well, that's ridiculous. I said, no, that's not ridiculous. We have made progress. Mm-hmm. I mean, we basically have eliminated slavery.
Mm-hmm.
200 years ago, you and I could have had a debate, and half of the audience would have been on one side or the other, that it was absolutely a normal thing.
Right.
And we're never going to get rid of slavery.
Right.
Well, we have. And we can move forward in war. Like I said, I think the way it's going to happen in the future is we're going to have to think more like police. And then, you know, who is the world's cop? It's another problem.
At this point, I'd like to have Carl read one more passage out of the book, just to give you a sense of the full sort of journey that this guy's gone through in the course of his life. And while he's reading this passage, I'd like you all to start forming your own questions. We'll have a microphone going around, and so please please join us. But this is indeed sort of full circle, and gets to sort of the issues of ritual that Carl's talking about, if not before war, then in this particular case, after war. It's only a pity that he had to do this among himself and with his family, and not perhaps in a more communal setting with the world.
You know, the veterans are isolated. This was after I had figured out that I had PTSD, and one of the great VA counselors, a guy named Larry Decker, who lives up here by Santa Barbara, had said to me, he said, you know, I've never seen anybody get through this without some kind of a spiritual component. And so typical of me, you know, I said, okay. So I went to the yellow pages and I looked up churches, you know. I lived in a little town called Los Olivos. So then there was one that was just only 3 blocks away from where I live. I said, well, I'll start with that one. And it happened to be an Episcopal church. And I went in to talk to the priest and he says, I don't know anything about war. I don't know anything about PTSD, but there's this guy up the valley, a Capuchin monk named Brother David. I call him Brother Mark in the book. He has been dealing with war and veterans. Maybe you should go talk to him. So I went to him, and he said, yeah, what is it? I said, I need a spiritual counselor. Why? My psychological counselor said so. So anyway, what transpired with this was after a while, he said to me, there's an old Catholic ritual called the Mass for the Dead, and I think we should do this with you. And he said, I'm going to do this, just you and me, in the old Santa Ynez mission, and I want you to think about who you're going to talk to, because in the Mass for the Dead, we invite the dead to come to Mass with us. So I went, okay, and this is the passage. It was 2 a.m. and dark. The dead had been summoned for several days before and were now gathering outside Old Mission Santa Ynez. It was cold for Southern California and wet. 6 months of drought had just been broken by the first Pacific storm, and the surfers were reporting 24-footers. My friend, Brother Mark, a Capuchin friar, had spent the evening before with a friend of his, a former nun, setting up candles and laying out the tools of ritual, and the large old mission was hushed in their glow. On the floor in front of the altar stood a large single paschal candle, the sign of the risen Christ, and deeper yet and beyond, into 20,000 years of our common ancestry, it was the power of the phallus rising from the earth. I had spent the evening writing what I wanted and never had a chance to say to my dead friends killed in the Vietnam War. Brother Mark was in full regalia. If we're going to do this thing, Carl, we're going to do it full force with 2,000 years of tradition behind it. It was the Mass for the Dead. I handed Brother Mark my diary, the battered book that I had kept with me every day I was in Vietnam. It was with me on every godforsaken hilltop in the mountains of the north. It was with me in every firefight. It was with me when Isle died and when Utter died. And it was with me when I died. It was with me on the hospital ship Repose. It was with me when I was drunk on my butt at Vandegrift Combat Base. Along with it was a small green notebook filled with medevac numbers, R&R dates for kids in the platoon, notes about the last Red Cross message to talk to the 3 kids who hadn't written home in the past 2 months and whose mothers were wanting to know if they were okay, hastily scribbled defense plans, hole arrangements, machine gun fields of fire, possible lines of approach by an attacking force. It had patrol checkpoints and daily brevity codes for radioing in positions. Cigarettes will be at 7530, NFL stars at 8131. I could radio in that we were located at from Pall Mall up 11 and right 5, or from Horning down 3 and right 7, and the skipper could figure out where we were so we could rain down fire and death on others than ourselves. Brother Mark placed these books on the altar next to the wine, water, and bread. You ready? I nodded. He handed me a silver spoon, and I spread frankincense on the glowing charcoal in the censer. I carried it, tossing smoke, while Brother Mark spread holy water, and together we walked toward the huge oak doors at the far end of the aisle. Brother Mark unlocked the doors. I pushed them open into the night. Welcome, friends of Carl. Welcome, former enemies. We welcome you. Come in. I felt them filing in. They had been waiting patiently, gathering outside beneath the dry grass hills dotted with dark green oaks, gathering there to wait there in the dark. They had waited for a quarter of a century, and they filled the church. My dead friends, kids who died before I even learned their names, North Vietnamese soldiers I had killed, and ones of my friends had killed, shadows and wraiths connected with us all and connecting us to each other. I had invited an officer I just hated. It hadn't been easy. Truly, there was a time when I wanted to kill him. A friend talked me back to normal insanity. But I knew there could be no forgiving of myself without the forgiving of him, and I also knew that he never thought too highly of me either. Then my grandparents all filed in and sat down in the front pew. We began the Mass. About halfway through, I stopped Brother Mark. "What's going on?" he asked. "They've all gotten up and crossed the aisles. They're hugging one another and shaking hands." We waited about 5 minutes until they got back into their seats again. I read aloud to them what I'd written the night before. "Anderson, all the sergeants thought you were a kind of a fuck-off. Maybe you did too, but on Helicopter Hill you did everything, gave your life, maybe to prove you weren't. You're not a fuck-off in my mind. Thank you." I told Clifton, "You took me on my first patrol. You took out the machine gun and died. Thank you, teacher." All I'd learned from Clifton probably saved many others long after he died. I told Isle how sorry I was I'd rushed him that day to kill the retreating NVA. He piped back, "Hell, Lieutenant, I was a Marine. I wanted to kill them too." Others laughed, even the NVA. I told the officer I was sorry for hating him so. I thanked him for coming. "I know you thought I was just a fucking hippie. Neither of us was a perfect officer. I forgive you. Please forgive me." When I saw him seated below me on one of the pews, he was no longer an old man against whom I'd held bitter anger for all these years. He was a relatively young man, killed when he was around 38 or 40. I saw him as a young man, assigned a battalion in combat, and in over his head. I no longer felt angry. I felt sad. He and I just looked at each other and understood where we both had fallen short.
Wow. Thank you.
Yeah.
So at this point, let's we have microphones, and we've got people with raising their hands. Terrific.
Thank you. This is an amazing discussion. I'm curious, we've generally been removed from the experience of warfare, at least for the last 10 years, if not 30 years. What effect do you think the draft had on the national psychology behind warfare during Vietnam? And do you think it's been an asset or a detriment to our dealing with warfare in these two current conflicts?
Well, boy, have we got time for a long answer? I think that the Republic's in danger because only a tiny percentage of the Republic is fighting its wars. When the draft was on in World War II, all segments of society went to war at that plaque at Yale. During Vietnam, there was the 2S deferment. And that's when we first started fighting our wars with the lower classes instead of the upper classes. And because there was so much political heat about the draft, they went to the all-volunteer military. And I still think we're fighting our wars with our lower classes and not our privileged classes. Mm-hmm. How many Ivy Leaguers, people from Stanford, Pomona, even look at the military as an option, much less join it? And I'll tell you this, my cautionary tale. There was a fierce battle where Hannibal handed the Romans their rear ends, called the Battle of Cannae, about 200 BC. It was fought across the mountains from Rome, and it was such a slaughter that the Carthaginians actually had to go in shifts to kill the Romans because they got tired, their arms got tired killing them. One quarter of the Roman Senate lost its life in that battle, and three quarters of the Roman Senate lost immediate family members. All right, that's lesson number one. What happened after that battle is that the Roman Senate decided to isolate all the soldiers who had lived, because they said, well, you must have been cowards because everybody else died. And they would not let them go back into the Roman towns. They made them stay in encampments outside of town. Does this sound familiar? And a prominent Roman named Scipio, who was from the Scipio family, who had money, who was also a survivor of Cannae, began to take care of these soldiers. And he began to look after their welfare. He began to pay them and help them. And their loyalty began to shift from the Republic to Scipio. And he used these veterans as his nucleus of his force to defeat Carthage. He became Scipio Africanus, one of the great Roman generals. 200 years later, a Roman army under Julius Caesar invades Rome. Loyalty had shifted completely away from the Republic. And if our elites aren't involved, he who pays the piper calls the tune. And there's no fear in my mind about it happening today. The military is firmly ensconced in civilian control. But I can see the resentment building. I was at Fayetteville, North Carolina, doing a reading, and a young couple came up, and you know, she's got a baby in her left arm, and she's got, you know, a toddler dragging behind her in the right arm, and he's in his fatigues, and he's standing. They look like they're about 4 years out of high school. And she just begins bawling, not tears, bawling. And I go, she finally gets together, what's the matter? And she turns to her husband, and she says, well, he's shipping out again in 2 days. And I turn to this kid, and I say, wow, is this your second tour? No, sir, it's my seventh. Oh. This is a republic? We're in danger. So that's my answer.
Excellent.
I'm new at aware, you know, being aware of this subject, but I'd like to ask you, could they form like committees or something to bring awareness to the military ongoing, you know, because we're going to have maybe future wars, and we should be, you know, the public should be well aware how the soldiers are going to take part on their duties. You know, it should be like, you know, pass laws of the military being more informative. Public being more informative.
Yes.
To what's really going on.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. You're absolutely right. And I think there are concrete things that can be done that are not difficult.
Go ahead. I just think, like, you know, form a committee of citizens for vets, which gives constant public information what's going on, and support and knowledge of the whole aspect of war.
Are you a veteran, sir?
Yeah.
Well, but yeah,
we need more, you know, awareness for the public.
Yeah,
for military duties.
Where did you fight?
Pardon?
Where did you fight?
I was like the National Guard.
National Guard.
On the National Homeland.
Good. Yeah, I don't think that we're talking about rocket science here in terms of, I mean, first of all, if there was just a simple thing like a national service. I mean, not everybody should be a soldier or a Marine. I mean, Marines are, you know, endurance athletes, and not everybody's got the genetic structure to do that. I mean, but everybody's got the ability to help. And if out of that pool, people could volunteer and other people could, I mean, God, think of the things we need to do. I mean, teach kids how to read. I mean, build Forest Service trails. We could replace all the people at the Transportation Security Administration with, you know, 18-year-olds. Be a lot more pleasant anyway. And I mean, there's a ton of things that people could do to pitch in. And then the sense that an isolated part of the culture is doing all the fighting wouldn't be the same. It'd be like, well, we all are doing our national service, and some of us do it as soldiers, and some of us do it as teachers. But it's a different feeling than, well, we're paying them to do it, see? I mean, that's, and I think simple things, I mean, like the chaplains could easily teach the corpsmen, the medics, simple rituals to handle dead friends, bury dead enemies, so that years of repression wouldn't have to happen. That during the battle, you're not gonna do any of this kind of thinking, but as soon as you can afterwards, simple rituals like that. I'm onto this because we'd been in a terrible battle, and we were in a defensive position this time, and we had dead enemy laying downhill from us. We'd thrown them down there, and I was coming around inspecting the holes, and a couple of the kids had ears in their helmets. They had cut the ears off of the dead in front of their hole, and it's, you know, they had big rubber bands around there with their helmets, and then they stuck their ears in there. I mean, these are 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds. It's sort of like Letterman sweaters, you know. And you get darn numb, you know. And I wasn't even angry with him, but I just knew that this, you can't have this. And so I just said to him, I said, look, I know they killed your friends. I know, but you know, you killed their friends, and you killed them. And I said, you just can't do this. So I punished them by making them take the ears off their helmets, and then going and burying those bodies. Now, this wasn't trivial, because it's not just hard work to dig a grave, but we were still getting shot at. And so they were down there digging a grave under fire. It was pretty sporadic. I wouldn't have sent them down there if it wasn't, but it was scary. And they both started crying. Mm. And I went, and I remembered that. By God, it didn't make them any worse Marines that night. We still had a heck of a fight on our hands, and they did just fine. But I have a feeling that touching that at that moment probably helped them later.
No, it's a good question, because I certainly read this book, and I wonder where Carl's going to go next. because there's such passion and advocacy in this book that it almost begs to go beyond the pages itself. Another question?
You discussed, briefly mentioned the predator situation, where it's really getting to the point where it's just a video game.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a real evolution from hand-to-hand combat to a video game.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder whether you've thought about the implications of this on the culture level. We're not going to have any more hand-to-hand combat. Hardly, it seems like. We're just going to have video games, and we're going to accomplish the same thing. I mean, that seems to be the cultural view, the cultural perspective, and I wonder what significance that has on the national psyche. Does it mean that we don't need an excuse? We won't need an excuse. We won't need a pretext. We won't need a Tonkin Bay resolution, mm-hmm. or whatever in the future. Right now we're going around the world just killing with impunity. There's mm-hmm. no or little control on any of these mm-hmm. predator facilities. Right. At least that's what I've heard. So. Does it just mean that it's going to continue in this mode, and what effect is that going to have on society?
Yeah, unless we get conscious of what's going on, it will continue, and it'll have a negative effect. Just think about hand-to-hand combat. There's a natural break on violence. First of all, I wanted to get out of there as fast as I could, because I might die. Now, a guy in Nellis Air Force Base has no fear at all. He's not going to die. So there's one thing, the carnage. I mean, you look at dismembered bodies of your friends or your enemies, and you go, like, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to do this. all of those natural breaks that we have now in warfare are going away. And so the only thing that you can replace those breaks with is an increase in consciousness about what we're doing. And it is becoming too easy. I mean, it is becoming part of normal life. Whereas before, I talk about the sacred space, I call it the Temple of Mars. You actually had to leave the country. You actually had to go someplace, take time, get there, do your killing, then come back and you re-enter. If it becomes part of ordinary life, I mean, there's no coming home anymore. You never left. It was just part of everyday commuting. And I think that that's where we're heading. I mean, you cannot say, I mean, we're going to have little robots that are going to go around corners and shoot people. And that's going to happen. I mean, I was at the Air Force Academy, and they used to have a huge mess hall, you know, ceiling, you know, 4 stories high. They used to have an airplane hanging over all the cadets. They replaced it last month with a drone. And I was talking to one of the guys about the kind of person that they're looking for to be at the Air Force Academy. They're no longer looking for people who are eagle-eyed and aggressive. They're looking for people that can run these machines, because that is the way the future is going.
One more question. Anyone just dying to ask the question more than anyone else? We have the mic to this gentleman back there.
Yeah, Sherman said that the purpose of an army is to break things and hurt people. And I was trained as a tanker, and you know, we went out and our job is to kill enemy tanks and the crews with them. Now we send people who are infantry trained, grunts, killers, and we want them to be peacekeepers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see that as good. I see that as something that's going to really cause them problems in the field. I think perhaps you should have a separate, I don't know, MOS as a peacekeeper.
Yeah.
And
no, I agree. I mean, that's what I'm saying, is that we're confusing police work with warrior work, and it requires a completely different type of personality, a whole different level of restraint. And we need to examine very closely when we commit warriors to police work, we're going to get in trouble. I agree with you completely. And I also think that we need to think about, you know, even if you think that we're going to commit policemen, there are so many ways of bringing influence on a country whose way of life you want to change. Let's face it, that's what we want to do in Afghanistan. That's what we want to do in Iraq. Take the example of South Africa. South Africa eliminated apartheid with the aid of the world community, helping the people who were against apartheid. We did not send the Marines to South Africa. We wouldn't play rugby with them. We wouldn't invest in their businesses. We wouldn't allow them to, you know, participate in normal functions in the international community. A great deal of pressure can be applied before you have to send the warriors in. And I think that that's something that our policymakers have gotten very fuzzy about. And the role of a warrior, the role of a policeman, and when is it appropriate to commit this one to that job and this one to that job. So I agree with you.
And I'd add to that the role of the writer to bring it to all our attention. To the Library Foundation, a round of applause for this evening and for their work. And to Carl Melantris.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Great pleasure.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.